Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B.
Today's guest is Stephen Cook, 20 years of combination experience, president of the International Association of Firefighters Local 117, currently captain with the Logistics Division of Birmingham Fire Rescue Service, but before the change of position was captain on Busy Quint 20. He was introduced to the fire service by his roommate who was a volunteer. Although he had no aspirations of becoming a firefighter, once he got a taste of it, everything going forward changed. Stephen laid out some facts and nuggets when it came to various topics we discussed. I truly enjoyed our conversation and hope the listeners do as well. With that, I present Stephen Cook.
I'm Stephen Cook. I'm a captain for Birmingham Fire and Rescue Service. I've worked for Birmingham for 17 years, and I got into the fire service because of my roommate in college. He was a really good friend of mine that I had a ton of respect for. He was a volunteer. I saw him going to do fire department things every day while we were supposed to be doing classwork. And I thought, that is really interesting. And I started doing that, and that led me to wanting to do this full time. And my dad could not have been happier. And my mom cried for a week after I told her I wanted to be a firefighter.
All right. So obviously, you know, your roommate is what sparked this whole thing. So did you go volunteer at the same department your roommate was on, or like how did you get your feet into the door?
Yeah, I went to Auburn University, and Auburn certainly at the time, 25 years ago, was really, really rural. The area surrounding Auburn, it was all volunteer, still is all volunteer. And our house was in a trailer park across the street from the fire station. And my roommate grew up in the fire service at home in Loxley. We were both in Air Force ROTC together at Auburn. And he was going, it was so intriguing. I had no background in the fire service, no even inkling that I wanted to be a firefighter whatsoever, until I started hanging out. And honestly, the camaraderie that I felt in the fire department was more than what I was getting in the military, surprisingly. And that is what I was looking for. It was awesome.
Okay. So you joined the volunteer fire service. I'm assuming they issued gear. You did your, hopefully you got your training and whatnot. At what point did you decide, like, if I can do this for a career, I want to go about doing it?
Yeah, I just thought it was something to do during college for the first probably year and a half that I did it. I was just telling a buddy of mine about this. We made a call on the interstate. We covered like 10 miles of I-85 in Lee County, and a kid that was the same age as me, 19-ish, had hit a guardrail with his driver's side door, and the guardrail sort of blended his legs up, like it curled up inside the floor pan, and amputated both of his legs. And we were working to get him out of there, and he just kept telling us, thank you, I'm so sorry, you have to do this. And it, as ridiculous as that seemed to me at the time, it felt so rewarding. We're a volunteer department. Today we're making $75,000 in Birmingham. We were making 200 calls a year or something like that. And that was the first one that was like, something like this that's meaningful is what I want to do. And after that, it's been an interesting 20 years, because not a lot of calls directly stick with me, but a few of them are really imprinted on me. And that's definitely one of them. That's definitely what led to, I think I can do this all the time.
Okay. And once that notion was in your head, in your mind, did you go out and apply any and everywhere, or was there one particular department that attracted you?
No, I think with my family, there was still an expectation that I would finish college and be a lawyer or whatever I was going to do. And I kind of thought, if I commit to the fire service, it's going to let people down, and they're not going to understand why I would want to do this, especially after my family has sent me to college to definitely not be a firefighter. And so I was still at the time committed to finishing college and figure out what I was going to do as a white collar professional. And it just like it kept hanging on me that I think I need to talk to my parents. They've been separated since I was 9 years old. So I talked to my dad, and he could not have been more supportive of the entire idea. He loved it. And I thought, well, maybe I will do this. So I finished school and actually did construction for a couple years, trying to apply. That was, I finished college in 2006. And so the recession was right after that. And the class that I started in Birmingham when I got hired in Birmingham, we took the test with 3,600 people for 21 spots. And honestly, I still can't believe that I got the job. I had no connection to anybody. Nobody in my family was in the fire service or, worked in local government or anything like that. So I still feel incredibly lucky that I've gotten to do this. And there are days when it's frustrating, but I still love coming to do this every single day.
Out of 3,600 candidates, they only
Yeah.
took 21.
21. And it was in, we had to test in waves. Because at the Civic Center, there wasn't enough room in the Civic Center to give us all the tests at the exact same time.
Wow. And was Birmingham the only organization you applied to since it was close to home?
Yeah, so I lived a little bit south. I still do live a little bit south of Birmingham, right outside the city. I also applied to my hometown, which is Pelham, and I still have a little spite against them for not hiring me, but I could not have been luckier that I didn't go to Pelham and I did go to Birmingham. I at the time, with no background in it, I didn't know the difference in a metro department and a suburban department and what that would look like. And being on a metro fire department, going to fires every day, that is definitely what I would have wanted to do if I had known. And I'm glad I went that route.
Okay. So you apply, you get hired, you get the phone call, the letter in the mail. I'm assuming did you have to do some sort of recruit academy?
Yeah, ours is it's about 6 months because it includes EMT. Our firefighter one and two is about 15 weeks. So yeah, we did we hired February 2nd, 2009, and June 6-ish, something like that. We went into the field.
Okay. Now, with you having a previous experience, being a volunteer, was it easy for you to transition into going, the career route through an academy, or was it a little bit difficult?
I don't know. Was it? It's interesting. Our as it doesn't matter how hard I think your recruit class is, or how hard others are. Everybody thinks that theirs was the hardest, and you had the tightest group of people. Obviously, we all trauma bond together while we're being tortured every single day. And that was like it was almost refreshing to me. I still have blisters on my heels from 20 or 17 years ago, hiking around in rubber boots all day long, every day. But was it difficult? I don't know that it was difficult. It was definitely a change from what I was doing. The biggest thing that I couldn't wrap my head around was the we do a 24/48 schedule, and having to like explain what that meant to my wife and what it meant to our growing family and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Upon completion, what was your first assignment?
I went to 1-5, which is an engine company in West End in Birmingham. It's a not the busiest, one of the busier, and that was my introduction to urban firefighting. It was, it can be rough sometimes in any big department, I guess. You go to a murder every day, you go to a fire every day, and that's what it was. That was exactly what we were told in recruit school it would be at the busier houses.
Okay. Now, once you got, your feet wet, you bonded with your crew a little bit. Did you seek out anyone in particular to kind of like emulate or just kind of see how their work ethic is, and that way, you can kind of reflect on your own to make you better?
Man, that is, that is a great question. And looking back on it, very early on, I took earned time and started taking our driver operator series classes at our state fire college and stuff like that. And Birmingham had a battalion chief, not my battalion chief, but a battalion chief who taught those classes. And he had such a wealth of knowledge. I felt like there was no way, like he would forget more than I would ever learn, is how I felt at the time. And really looked up to the way he treated his guys, what he expected out of his guys. And he wasn't even my battalion chief. I was definitely jealous of the guys who did have him. He worked in my battalion, but not on my shift. And he just retired as the fire chief of one of our suburban departments nearby. He ended up going on to be the fire chief for several years.
Okay. With that being said, what key piece of advice can you give to whether you've been in the fire service for many, many years or you're new coming into it when it comes to mentorship?
Man, it's we have a mentorship program, or I guess the skeleton of a mentorship program, and I don't know how much weight I put into a formalized mentorship program. Is that what you mean, or do you mean in any aspect of it?
I mean, really, with all your experiences, what you've been through, everything you've seen, kind of with that, how does mentorship play a factor with anybody coming into the fire service?
The variability of officers, management, firefighters, and all in fire service classes, we talk about like official leaders and then also unofficial leaders. And I think if I was looking for a mentor, I think we're organically and naturally led to the people that we look up to and we want to talk to. And I would say one of the greatest pieces of advice that I've had in the fire service that is directly related to this is, I had an officer who told their battalion chief, "We are going to be your," and then he named another officer. "We want to be as good as this other officer," to his battalion chief. And his battalion chief said, "You'll never be that officer. You need to be the best you that you can be." So should we be looking to a specific individual and emulating that? I think we can take pieces of, we can learn something from every single person we run into. Great fire officers, bad fire officers, great and bad firefighters. There's something to learn from every single person. That's a blessing that I see in a metro department, is the diversity of the people that I work with. I would have not had the ability, unless I was in the military or another giant organization, I would have never had the opportunity to hang out with the people that I do get to hang out with every single day, see things from a completely different viewpoint than I get to see, and then truly consider that viewpoint of, does this mean something to me? How can I implement this in the decisions that I make and the actions that I take? So as far as official mentorship or direct mentorship, like I said, I don't know that those programs, I think maybe the people who say, "Yeah, I want to be a mentor," maybe those aren't the people we always need to look toward to follow. But the people you organically see as something you want to emulate, you need not figure out how to do it exactly like them. Figure out what it is about those decisions that you appreciate and respect, and lead yourself down that path.
No, I 100% agree. You're spot on because, I'm a newly promoted officer part-time. And when I say part-time, I only ride the seat whenever there's a vacancy within the shift or my captain is off. So I do look at certain attributes that he does, but I don't want to be him. And I don't mean that in a negative light. Like, I want to be my own person, but I do watch the certain things he does, and it's like, okay, I can do it kind of like that, but I don't want to be another insert name here 2.0. I want to be my version of that. So I 100% agree with that.
Man, and the guys that work under you can spot somebody pretending. I know that I can see it in people who I know are trying to pretend. I know they can see it in anybody else. If you're trying to pretend to be something you aren't, you have to have that confidence that you're making the right decision, you're making it based off of some standard, and it can't be false. It has to be, you have to be a real person in this job. You spend too much time together to not be a genuine person making genuine decisions. And like I keep saying, just pretending to be somebody else is never the answer. I've learned just as much from people that I truly do not like as I have from people that I do like, and sometimes in a positive way, not necessarily in a negative way. But you've got to figure out what makes you and go that way, not try to be John Salka. He's an unbelievably good officer who a ton of people look up to, but only John Salka is going to be John Salka.
Yes, for sure. Okay. When did you start? When did you decide to start moving up the ranks and why?
I have a pretty diplomatic position, and then I have a more realistic position, and we can talk about both of those. From the more diplomatic and honest position, I felt like we're blessed with the experiences, but you can't get to the point where you're challenged in decisions unless you have the authority to make those decisions. So by no means do I think I'm the most experienced firefighter at all, not at all. But after, I don't know, like if you think about a master's degree or a postgraduate degree or a trade, a master electrician needs to be in the job for 4 or 6 years, something like that, before they can be a master electrician. Or you go to mass, you get your master's degree over the course of 2 years. And again, I'm not saying 2 years is the answer, but there becomes a period of time where you say, okay, either I've got this figured out or I don't. And if I have it figured out, I need to pass this on to somebody else, give somebody else the opportunity to do what I'm doing so that the person in front of me can move up themselves. Let everybody move to the next spot and learn something new. And I really did feel that way, that I needed to give somebody else the opportunity. And then on a selfish, completely selfish standpoint, the people who get promoted sometimes, I know if I don't get promoted, I got to listen to them. And I definitely don't always want to listen to that person. So if it's me or them, I'm certainly going to try hard and make sure it's me. A big impression that my dad has given me through my entire life is if somebody's offering you the opportunity to give your opinion, give it. Because if you don't give yours, somebody's going to give theirs. And then you're going to have to, whatever reason they're asking for that, you're going to have to live by their opinion. So be the person who can influence the decisions going forward. And that requires taking on authority and taking on responsibility, not taking on authority, but mainly taking on responsibility. So that was my thought process of moving on up. Also, our second step is driver operator. And who doesn't want to drive a fire truck? It's still the best job I've ever had. If they pay me what they pay me now and I could go back to driving fire trucks, I would. It was wonderful. The best time of my career, hands down.
that was gonna kind of be my next question because I've had several Birmingham personnel on here, but so you go from firefighter to driver, and then what else to what else?
Yeah, then lieutenant, then captain, battalion chief. And after battalion chief, you're an at-will employee in the executive staff.
And are you allowed to skip rank or no?
You can only skip driver.
You
We
can only
call them
skip.
sergeants now. At the time I was an apparatus operator, they didn't call me a sergeant.
So with that being said, obviously you went from firefighter to driver, correct? And then at what point were and when you were a driver, did you decide like I'd like to move into that right front seat to make an impact and make those important decisions?
I don't know how it worked out this way. So we have lieutenants and captains. Our captains can ride up as the battalion chief in the battalion car. And at nearly every assignment I've had, I've been on the captain's shift. So what happens pretty often is the captain is gone and rides up. They also have tons of time, so they are constantly taking vacation. But if they're not, they're in the car because the battalion chiefs have even more time. So the captains are riding up, and we don't backfill their spot with a lieutenant. We backfill it with whoever their driver is. So pretty early on, I was already doing it. I was already, whether I wanted to or not, I would have much preferred to just drive the fire truck. But because the captain was gone, I was doing it anyway. We have some requirements to sit for that promotional step. So you already have your instructor and your officer anyway, so you already have that educational background. And as a driver, I started teaching at our state fire college and teaching the apparatus operator series, pumper and aerial. And there were a lot of people who were encouraging me to go on from there. And that was, man, I love that job so much that if there was anything that was holding me back, it was to know that I would have to give up driving that truck and not get to drive it anymore. Haven't gotten to be assigned to a fire truck in a long time these days. Not to drive in one.
If I can ask your personal opinion on that, it varies from who you ask or what part of the country you're in, but I've heard the company officer is the best position in the firehouse. I firmly believe it's the driver's role. And granted, I am now in that role. Like I've wanted it, I've yearned for it, and I finally got it. To me, there's no better position because you play both. And it's that fine balance where if a firefighter wants to come talk, they don't necessarily want to go talk to the captain. They'd be like, well, let me go talk to the driver. So what's your opinion and take since you've had both on, in your opinion, which is better?
Yeah, I'm 100% on board with your representation there. That's exactly how I felt. You are clearly, at least in the way we operate, you are clearly still one of the guys. You are not management. You're not writing anybody up. You're not doing anything related to that. We say you're holding it in the road until the adult gets back. So, but when you're on calls, you're expected to act to a level of professionalism and a level of knowledge where you can be trusted. And they're not just going to let you, they're not going to give you the reins on all these guys and a $1 million truck if they don't trust you to do that job. So I really enjoyed being part of the guys. You're back with the peons in the open bunk room. You're not in the officers' quarters. You're part of it. But you're right. Just the natural progression of things. People are going to come to you with issues and problems. And is this worth taking up to somebody else? Can we figure this out on our own? And I love being a driver for those reasons. A big change that I chose to make when I made officer is I tried to give the crew. I remember being a firefighter, and I didn't want the officer hovering over us all the time. Even if I liked the officer, it was like, if you work in a cubicle, you wouldn't want your boss standing behind you watching you type emails all day. If you needed a break or you needed to, if you just wanted to get away, you shouldn't have to go run away from the officer. And I gave the day room to the crew when I was a lieutenant, and I would stay out of it. It wasn't my place, that was their place. And I respected that idea, but I'll assert I missed that. I missed getting to hang out with the guys. So I would treat the kitchen table would be like my middle ground. I'd hang out at the kitchen table. They didn't have to come to the kitchen table. They could go hide in the day room and get away from me. But as a driver, I never felt like you were separated. You were part of it. It's like it was like a Mustang position in the military. Somebody who was enlisted and becomes an officer, they get a ton of respect because they've seen it from both sides. And while I think there are some really good officers who skipped our role of driver in Birmingham and went straight to lieutenant, I also see the benefit that I got, the sort of stepping stones of going driver and then officer, and I wouldn't have given that up at all for anything.
Okay.
Yeah,
Love
I
it.
could have been making more money already right now if I had skipped driver, but not skipping it was 100% worth it.
So when you became captain, was your first assignment Quint 20, or is that something that you kind of eventually made your way to?
Yeah, so as a lieutenant, as a driver firefighter, I worked on the west side of town. As a lieutenant, they gave me the opportunity to go downtown into our financial district and high-rise district, and I got to work downtown. And my driver on my crew was a classmate of mine from recruit school. We are close friends, and I was 100% content was staying there for my entire career. I had no desire to go anywhere else. The crew was amazing. The crew still is amazing. And it was truly like hanging out with your friends, everybody looking out for each other. It didn't feel like I was coming to work ever. And I told Luke, my driver at the time, "Hey, I'm not going to take the captain's test." And he said, "Well, if you don't take the captain's test, I won't take the lieutenant's test." Unfortunately, I had already taken a previous captain's test. So I felt like a jerk because I got promoted off of that previous test in a secondary group of promotions. And I had to leave that crew, and that was rough. But I got to go home to Quint 20, which is where I was also a driver. And that being the captain of Station 20 was the pride of my career. Absolutely the pride of my career. It is, those guys made 4,242 calls in 2025. That's a call every 2 hours. And, I talked about trauma bonding in recruit school, but when you make a call every 2 hours, you are either all in or you are ready to kill somebody on that truck.
Okay. If you don't mind, that way the listeners plus myself can kind of get a sense of it. Can you talk about the area, the station, the personnel, the call volume?
Yeah, it's a so it is the west side of Birmingham is a battalion, and in that battalion, Quint 20 is one of two truck companies. It's a Quint, it's not, it runs as an engine and as a truck. But just by the area, 20 ends up getting 90% of all the fires over there. And then we send two trucks to all the apartments. So even if the other truck ends up going, the Quint goes as well. Every shift, there's an expectation that you're going to at least one fire, if not multiple fires. Everybody there has had four or five, six fire shifts across all three. I mean, it's unbelievable how many times you go to, and you go first year. Firefighter Steven would have never imagined you'd reach the point where you're just like, it wouldn't hurt my feelings if we didn't get dispatched one more time to a fire today.
Damn.
I'm tired and my knees hurt. But you get the good thing is every single time, every day you're getting to do what you signed up for. On top of that, we would say that the currency of paying for those fires are the medical calls, and it's a low socioeconomic status area, a low education area, and the run volume is enormous based on people using the EMS service, just like everywhere else, using
Right.
it as primary care, lots of transports, lots of just nobody has anybody else to rely on, and they call the fire department, and we'll go every time. And we go and we fix their problem every time, which just encourages somebody else to call. And I get it. But, and we all knew that, like, nobody is. Nobody's forced into Station 20. If you work at Station 20, you volunteered to get there. You asked somebody to get there. and you knew what you were getting into. Nobody was is making somebody go be a slug attached to a crew where everybody has to work all the time. And that's a blessing. You know, you just didn't have to worry about some of the employee issues that you would have to worry about at a slower station.
Right. And is it a single piece house?
There is the battalion chief is there.
Okay.
There's the quint, and there's an ALS transport unit.
Okay. And I like how you mentioned it. At these busy houses, and I think it's well known throughout the fire service, if you're at a busy house, you don't have to worry about the slugs there. If one sneaks through the cracks and gets in, they will most likely get run out due to the call volume or due to the fact that the other individuals at that station are going to see, hey, listen, you're not fitting in. You probably need to go somewhere else.
That's exactly right. And you know, there's not a lot of we don't get to bid for positions in Birmingham at all. You know, we can, you know, you can beg all you want to, and there are some battalion chiefs that'll go to bat for you and ask for certain people, and you know, that might be the route you can go. But I've been impressed for 17 years that when somebody doesn't cut it at one of those really busy stations, they do not stay there long. Like one cycle of shifts, we have a 9-shift Kelly cycle, and you know, they may only see one Kelly day at that assignment, and then they're booted out to somewhere else.
Okay. As the company officer for Quint 20, my personal or in your personal opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
Yeah, that's I think everyone who works at 20 has the experience of either a battalion chief or an officer being sent to the station, and your understanding, whether it's gossip or real, is that someone in administration sent somebody there to slow these guys down because they're reckless or they're cowboys or something like that. And in every instance, I got to experience that as a driver. We got an officer who did not come from a background on a truck company at all. They would not have been known as go pick the best firefighting captain you can pick and send them over there. That's not what they were. But what's unbelievable to me is how quickly they assimilate into just the way it is because they realize if they don't let these guys get it done, it's not going to get done. The battalion chiefs lean on those crews that are busy crews, the crews that accept or that you know, people look to get to. The battalion chiefs lean on those guys to get more work done than what they should be expected to get done. So that's what aggressive means to me, is that there is no micromanagement required of those guys. They're aggressive in accomplishing tasks. They're not reckless. They're smart. They're experienced. And they're there to get that job done. And as crazy as it sounds, to get it done so they can get back in service. So hopefully they can do it again in 30 minutes or an hour, because they're going to do it in 30 minutes or an hour, whether you want them to or not. So that's my experience with aggressive. And I've worked around some crews that I thought were aggressive, in a negative sense, where they're, you know, it's not a, there's no strategy to it. There's just, I'm going to show how, I'm going to show my level of guts, I guess. And I'm going to go just walk into a house that's 100% on fire with no
Right.
plan of what you were going to do. That's not aggressive. That's bravado and showing off. That's not, in the outcome, you're not even showing off. You're going to get picked on and made fun of for being an idiot. So, not having to be micromanaged, not having to be told what to do. When I was a driver at Quint 20, my nozzleman, like I said, I ended up riding the seat like 75% of the time, probably. And so my nozzleman drove for me all the time. Very good friends with him. And one thing I bragged about him all the time is he always could see, he could foresee what the next step was. Often, very often, before the battalion chief, before anybody else, he would have the tool you needed ready for you before you realized you needed it. He would have the truck in position in the exact spot you needed it to be in before you realized you needed it. He was an incredible Nosman. He made the crew look good. He made the officer look good. And that's what I see as aggressive, is somebody who's ready to be in the right place, where, you know, you don't let something progress to be out of control because you've got it knocked out quickly, because you're aggressive,
right,
in a good way.
Right. Okay. I want to jump right into it with this next question. The leadership styles. You know, we talked before we started recording that, you know, there's different styles of leadership. I know through my experiences, I've seen good leadership and bad, and I think I've learned more from the bad, because it's like, if I ever get to a position of leadership, I never want to be like this individual. But far too often as well, we have individuals who try to, like, we kind of say, mimic the John Salkas, where it's like, bro, you need to find your way, your own path. But when it comes to leadership styles, and you mentioned you kind of want to correlate with teaching, what's your take on that?
Yeah, my wife has a master's degree in human development, and for her entire, as long as I've been in the fire service, I've been married to my wife. So, or from Birmingham, we got married in December and I got hired in February. So for, it has been a together situation. She got her master's degree I don't know, I probably had 5 years on or so, something like that. She got her master's degree in human development. Her bachelor's degree was also in human development. And we would sit around, and while she was typing papers or whatever, I would be helping her look through research about human development, specifically to whatever topic she was looking up. And what I found astonishing, and what we still talk about all the time, she will talk about an issue with a four-year-old, because that's like her specialty, is the pre-K age, the human development age before school. The consensus standard for the way a teacher approaches dealing with a kindergartner or a pre-K kid, it is the exact same standard that we teach in fire officer and instructor in dealing with an adult firefighter. The reality is, with a leadership style, if you can do your best to be a good person, your leadership style is going to work itself out. And a thing that I preach as a fire officer, or to people who want to be fire officers, is support the plugman. And it's kind of like, you know, the Marines support the grunt, support the rifleman. That's such a small phrase that you're like, oh yeah, I know what that means. But do you know what that means? That encompasses an enormous amount of information. And how do you support the plugman? If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you have to meet every single one of those, or let your plugman meet every single one of those. It's your responsibility to make sure that they are safe and secure, and they're given the equipment that they need, and they know how to use the equipment, and they're confident in it. And that, I think, to like at on Quint 20, those guys were the best firefighters they could be, because the steps right under in Maslow's hierarchy, self-actualization is at the top, being the best you can be. Right under that is pride and belonging. And those guys are, all of them would consider each other best friends or brothers or whatever it is. All of that is a piece of supporting the plugman. They are not going to be the best they can be if you're treating them like garbage, but they're also not going to be the best that they can be if you're not holding them to super high standards. And it's your responsibility as an officer to make sure they can meet those high standards. I love one of the questions that you had in the email you sent was, you know, what do you think is more important, education or experience? Was there a third one in there?
Years of service, education, yep. Work ethic, or on the job experience.
And I know it's a cop out. It sounds like a cop out, but the reality is it has to be a perfect combination of all of those. You can't stop your education in the fire service and expect that experience is going to bring you through to the next level because it won't. You're just going to have the same amount of, there are guys who happily work for an entire career on Quint 20, but never want to move to the next level. And they've had, it's a lot of experience, but it's the same experience over and over and over and over. You have to add the education piece into it before it all comes together. And all of those, all the decisions, if you base them on, as ridiculous as it sounds, I know like firemen are not psychologists. They don't want to be psychologists. Fire officers don't want to be psychologists. That's not, nobody wants to do that.
Right.
But it's not hard to remember Maslow's hierarchy and whether it, when somebody comes to work and they're a jerk, they're not coming to work to be a jerk to me. Something's going on with them.
Right,
And
right.
if you're a good fire officer, it shouldn't just be you jumping all over them. If that's not the way they normally act, what's going on? You also ask like a mental health question, and I'm part of Birmingham's or the state of Alabama's in our peer support program. And that's one of the biggest things that's taught in our peer support program is like, if you ask a firefighter, hey, are you good? They're going to say, yeah, I'm good every single time. But if you have a bigger understanding of that and you say, okay, are you good? I know how you're going to answer that question. It should be, Danny, today you're being really quiet. What's going on? You have to put it in their court and make them justify their actions. And that's how you can actually take care of them. You make them, you say, I've noticed a change. What's going on? All of that falls into support the plugman. There is no one size fits all, but the reality is being a good person, the best person you can be for everybody else on your crew, supports that idea of support the plugman.
Yeah. And, it's one of those things too. Sadly, there are individuals in the fire service who believe with rank comes with doing less, or I want this title and it's about me. When it's like, if you are a company officer, it's not about you. You come last. It's about the
Exactly.
individuals you work for. And some just don't get that.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine who is a battalion chief here in Birmingham. He talks about in a professional development program for new officers. If it was 100% up to him, they're getting their new brass, they're getting their white shirts, they're getting their new helmets. He said the first thing he would assign are work gloves, and that's exactly the position that needs to be beat into understanding new fire officers. You should get work gloves, and the first thing that should wear out in your complement of things you were given should be those work gloves, and we'll give you more work gloves. Don't wear out the brass trying to get stuff done. A great sort of thought to go along with that is delegating jobs. As a fire officer, you can't do all the jobs. You
Correct.
shouldn't do all the jobs. You should delegate down. But if there are more things to do and you've run out of people to delegate to, you are a company officer. Go to work. Take your work gloves and go get the rest of it done. That is your responsibility. And that is talking about mentors.
Yeah.
That's what guys want to see. They want to see somebody who supports them in their decisions too, to go along, supports them in their labor. I've had a lot of guys who we talk about aggressive firefighters. I've had battalion chiefs come to me when, as certainly as a captain, but also as a lieutenant, and say, "Hey, we need to talk about your guys. They made whatever decision on this fire, and I don't agree with it. And you're going to counsel with them, or you're going to write them up, or telling me whatever the situation was. I didn't like it." And 100% of the time, I have never have yet, thank God, I have yet have to discipline anybody who works directly under me. And when that battalion chief comes to me and says, "I didn't like this decision your guys make," I may not even know what he's talking about. But every single time I have said, I told him to do that. And I would explain how, in a consensus standard or best practices, how they came to this decision. I told them to do that. If that was wrong, write me up. And they would say, oh, well, maybe I didn't understand the situation. And I have yet to be written up for standing up for my guys and supporting them to make a decision. Now, if they made a decision, again, knock on wood, I haven't had to deal with this yet, but if they made a decision outside of best practices, then we'll go have a conversation about that. But if you spend your time teaching and making them have a full understanding of the situation, then they can be aggressive and make the right decision. And when somebody pushes back and says, we don't think you should have done that, they can proudly say, I know why I did that. I did that because I was taught out of this manual or this standard that this is exactly what you're supposed to do in this situation. And it has saved a lot of heartache for me and for the guys that I've worked with.
In your personal opinion only, when it comes to situations like that, where you have, whether it's another company officer or a chief officer come to you with that type of, hey, you need to do this because I didn't like this, would you say, in your opinion, that it's due to a lack of education or a lack of knowledge? Because I say that because the fire service, some individuals in the fire service have a hard time where just because they have rank or tenure doesn't mean that they're always right. And just because the way they've done things means it still needs to be done this way, where we all know the fire service is progressively always changing.
Yeah, a lot of course it. I think maybe not having the education, but maybe those situations arise out of assumptions. And in those chief officers' experience, they have seen other people have maybe similar outcomes. And what caused that outcome was a poor decision, or maybe it was a lack of knowledge or whatever. And they assume that your people or you are in the exact same boat. And instead of taking that, like the example of back to kindergartners, kindergartners aren't coming in today to ruin their teacher's day. That's not happening. If something's going on, you need to understand what's going on. And in the same thing with the battalion chief in that situation, if you can come at them with a diplomatic mindset and say, I see maybe where you're coming from, what your concern was, I just want to let you know that this is where that came from. And having that back and forth with them on a regular basis, it goes from, I don't trust you, you need to discipline your guys for whatever, to, hey, come here. What do we need to do to fix this? And then you get to fix it in your way because you've made it work. When I got back to Quint 20, this is a great example of that. I got back to Quint 20 when I made captain, and the plugman that was there when I was the driver was now the nozzleman, and we went to a fire, maybe first or second shift, whatever. And when we pulled up, it was pushing good. That nozzleman can put out anything. I would have had no worries whatsoever. But the battalion chief that I was coming back to didn't know me from Adam. And if I undermined any amount of trust he had in my decisions to keep my crew safe that early on, I would have never been given the leeway to do what I was given the leeway to do after that. So, understanding the position that they're going to be in and the expectation they're going to hold, I was able to say, hey, Dom, we may not immediately be going in this. Let's give it a second. And afterwards, he said, hey, why would you keep me out of that? You would have gone in that when you were here before. You're absolutely right. And we knew the battalion chief at the time. If I ruin this, then the whole time I'm here as a captain, we're not going to be able to do anything. So I think it's assumptions that lead to those situations, the chiefs assuming they know how this outcome came to be, rather than having those conversations and saying, hey, this was a best practices. This is my justification. This is what I was looking at. And they may say, okay, well, in the future, just communicate that. And you have to be open to that. You can't take an emotional position to say, I was right, so I shouldn't have to do anything. Just if you have to add the caveat of explaining what you're about to do on the radio, just explain it and then
Okay.
go do whatever you want to do.
Okay. When it comes to Quint 20, if it arrives, are you, I just want to know, just personally, I want to know, are you guys more of a truck company? Because I understand, I'm not one of those guys that says, oh my God, if you have water on a truck, you guys need to figure out what you want to do. I firmly believe there are areas and situations where that's a plus to have both. But if you pull up first on scene, are you guys more of a truck company or are you an engine?
That is the biggest problem with Quint 20 is the guys who want to be the most experienced nozzleman in the city because the Quint goes to so many fires. They have such a driven crew that the amount of times that they arrive on scene first in their second due territory, and there's it's surrounded by other busy engine companies is often. That happens a lot.
Okay.
And it is a there's no, the doctrine and policies in Birmingham would allow a truck company to be on the line and an engine company to go do truck stuff. It depends on order of arrival and what needs to be done and several other things. Not that I necessarily agree with that. I love order of arrival, pre-designated tasks. I think that's the way it needs to go. But because of that, it's really hard to rein in sometimes those firefighters who want to be on the nozzle. And in some cases, the easiest thing to do to solve the problem is to put the fire out, of course. Single room, let's go kick the door down and put some water on it and do a search at the exact same time. So when you talked about being aggressive, I think that's a good example of maybe what's not best practices that the issue of having a quint has led to for us is we'll assign a guy, put a guy on the nozzle. This guy's been on a nozzle 8 times this week. He's fine. And a guy coming behind him is going to go search that entire house. And the officer is holding command and the driver is pumping and setting the truck up at the same time. But you can't do that with every single crew. You couldn't just grab a crew and say, go do all these things. And I'm our union president too. So it undermines our need for more people for to even be that. You don't want to be so good that you don't need to hire more people. So it has led to a lot of troubles. My goal was to focus us on truck work anytime we were on scene. And my driver, when I was there, he would always joke, "Hey, I can't wait for your Kelly day so we can put some fires out." And he would do that. He's riding the seat. If that's the decision he wants to make, and he's first on scene, he can do that. But I tried to keep it to truck tasks, and it didn't always work out that way.
Right. But, that's the thing. Like, if I didn't hear you state your reasoning, I'm assuming, like you just talked about earlier, when
Yeah.
you assume things, that's where things get out of order, things get out of whack.
That's exactly right. Are you talking about what? Why we would do what we do?
Exactly.
Assuming, yeah,
Exactly.
exactly. That's we would have that trouble sometimes. A battalion chief would say, "Hey, I can't have you guys on the nozzle. You've got to, first of all, let somebody else have the experience, but also I need you guys doing truck stuff." And the guys under me are arguing, "We're doing the truck stuff. We're just doing the truck stuff and the engine stuff." And honestly, doing it that way doesn't help anybody else learn. It doesn't give anybody else the experience. It also sets an expectation. If you take the nozzle away from an engine company every time you show up on scene, then there it becomes a common practice, and then you're expected to do it in a situation where we know there's a person trapped, we know where they are, and we have to put all of our efforts on getting that person out. So, I know that it's shooting ourselves in the foot to act that way
Okay.
sometimes.
Okay. You're like I said, this is another your personal opinion. Would you like to see at some point Do you think Birmingham would benefit more if they go the true truck engine route? Just your personal opinion.
100%. I think you can take our Quints, and it would probably take a period, like a paradigm shift of you're going to ride around with no water in this Quint, and you're going to primarily do truck work. Also, order of arrival pre-designations would help with that, where the truck's job when they get there, or the Quint's job when they get there, is to do the truck jobs first. And if we have to call an audible, then that's a whole different discussion. You should assume you're going to do truck things when you got there. And it's to the point where I think that's what it would take. It would take all the hose off that Quint, take the water out of the tank, and now go be a truck. And then, a year down the road, we'll give you everything back and you can go put out car fires on your own without having to call an engine company. But you're a truck. That's what it would, and things would be more efficient if we did things that way. I've had the conversations with our admin, and their concern is handcuffing the battalion chiefs to a fluid situation. And my position is, as an incident commander, why would you want to take on more like mental tasks than you would have to do? If everything can be set for you and all you have to do is decide whether you need to call an audible or not, why would you not appreciate that position? And having the truck do truck things, you know they're going to go force entry, you know they're going to go search, and they're just telling you when they're doing what they're already assigned to do, could not be a more effective way to put fire out and search the house.
Sounds like me and you have an agreement when it comes to PDAs. Like, I am a fan of predetermined assignments, and I've had conversations with others that are like, well, predetermined assignments are, they're not right, or whatever the case may be. But for me, if everybody responding to the scene knows they're on their order of arrival, their exact tasks, radio traffic's down.
Yes.
Work gets done faster. Like, to me, when you can flood the scene and everybody knows their respective assignments based on order of arrival, why wouldn't you want that?
Exactly.
But
The
then,
only thing you hear is this task is accomplished. This task is accomplished. This task
correct.
is accomplished. There's no ambiguity of, well, who's bringing the water supply? You know who's bringing the water supply.
Right.
I can't wrap my mind around. I would love to better understand it. I love the idea of find a position you don't agree with and learn it until you can make an argument for it. I just have yet in 20 years figured out a way to make an argument where it's better to just decide when we get here.
Yeah, that's okay. When it comes to outside training, are you a proponent of for an individual to get outside of their four walls of their firehouse to learn something? Not saying you have to bring it back and go, hey, we need to start doing this since yesterday, but getting outside your walls of your department and seeing other things. And I only mention that because I'm sure, well, I know you know this individual, and he's part of a cadre group that does things that are unorthodox. And when I'm going to mention Clay McGee, he's part of, man, I knew I was going to have a brain fart right there when I
Magic City
was,
Truck Academy.
thank you. Thank you very
Yeah.
much. Magic City
OJ was
Truck
just sitting in
Academy.
my office just right before we started.
Okay. So with that being said, what's your take on individuals going outside learning different things?
I think one of the toughest things to compete against for anybody in the fire service is incestuous fire training. One of the big, so there are a lot of people who have a lot of experience in an organization, and they are institutionalized into that organization. And you have no, like, yeah, I know that works. We've been doing it for 150 years here in Birmingham. I know that that is a viable excuse. What that keeps from happening, what incestuous fire training stalls is your ability to go away from your organization and see that, oh my gosh, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Look at these, there's 90 other options to accomplish this exact same task. And maybe some of them are easier than what we're doing. Maybe some of them are better than what we're doing. Maybe some of them we know for sure that that way sucks, but we don't know until we go see another way to do it. I think being around those other, a great example of this is we are in the deep South, the deep South. I participated in a curriculum review at IFSTA for the Pumper and Aerial Handbook. And there was a CAL FIRE guy who he was in their training division for CAL FIRE. And he jokingly said, "Man, we've been in here looking at PowerPoints for a long time. We need some grounding time." And I have lived in Alabama my entire life. I don't know what grounding time is. And literally, what they do in recruit school is if you're tortured with PowerPoints, we're going to go outside and take our shoes off and put our feet in the grass. And just on its face, that seems ridiculous. Well, it's so unridiculous. We got their justification and their wellness plan behind it with the intention that it looks like we're going to implement that piece of a wellness plan in Deep South Alabama, not just go put your feet in the grass, but their justification behind all those things, a mental health piece to recruit school. And if we had not branched out away from that, nobody around us is going to bring in the idea of the mental health piece to recruit school during recruit school. It would go the opposite way. It would be you're going to have to toughen up, and that's the only way you're going to accomplish anything. So I think that's one good example, but there's thousands of examples of let's see how somebody else is doing it. We don't have to implement it, but we can try it and see if it works for us. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I love taking those classes. I love doing hands-on training away from here. I love doing lecture away from here. Any reason to go see, this is our profession. This is our skill. If I was a carpenter, I'd want to go see how we hammer nails across the country. Same exact thing.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned grounding. My last station before I got promoted, one of my firemen came up to me. He was like, "Hey man, I'm gonna go outside and do some grounding." And I was like, "Okay, what's that?" And he was like, "So when you go outside, take your shoes off, your socks off, and you put your feet on the ground, and it kind of like he used the word it kind of like centers you, kind of like resets you." And I was just like, "Oh, okay, like interesting. I've never heard of that before." I thought he was
See,
joking
I
at
had to.
first, but he had like this look, and he's like, "No, I'm dead serious." And it's funny you just mentioned that, somebody else brought that in, and what it does to the psyche of individuals. So I was like, small world that you just mentioned that.
It and I what a great thing to even think about. And the fact that they think through like today's going to be a really strenuous day. The next day is not going to be you running 150 towers 2 days in a row. And their justification is, people get repetitive motion injuries and they wash out of recruit school. They don't need people washing out of recruit school. So they do a strenuous day and then they do a light day. They are issued what are they rolling the little foam rollers as part of their assigned items. They get that as part of their goods, and they do yoga on the low impact days. And it feels ridiculous as a salty fireman to say, "I want to go do some yoga today," but yoga feels good. Go do some yoga. Go
No,
do
for
some
sure.
grounding.
For sure. Okay. With what obviously you have the OGs, OJ Cloje and Clay McGee, that the whole Magic City Truck Academy. Now, granted, I don't expect you to go down the rabbit hole why the whole thing came about, but would you say everything that they're teaching, while some may find it, well, I'll never have to do that. I mean, here, what, not too long ago, you had an engine company arrive on scene, I forgot what state. They did the ladder splice and got a woman out a window. So who would have thought that would work? My question to you is, it kind of goes with outside, going outside the box, that you have that internal plug where you could pick the ideas of Clay and OJ and ask them, why would you do this? And so my question to you is, I'm assuming you probably still have some resistance within Birmingham of those two bringing those thoughts and ideas into fruition, correct?
Yeah. Nobody's an expert in their own tribe, right? The
That's
further away
right.
you get, that's when that's you're the expert if you can get as far away from your place as possible. Oh yeah, there's a lot of pushback against a lot of those ideas. We have a running joke of somebody bringing up in our in a battalion-wide training, even the discussion of a single man ladder carry for a 24-foot extension ladder. The discussion was, what if you step in a hole? And we say that to each other all the time when it's anything outside of whatever the easiest, most normal situation is. But if you don't go try to carry a 24-foot extension ladder by yourself, if you don't try to set a ladder on top of a car, and we teach at fire academies all over the place. In this big sterile drill field with concrete, hundreds and thousands of yards of concrete poured in every direction. And then the first fire you get to is a fire blowing out of a balcony in an alleyway. And there's 8 feet of space to set up trucks and ladders and everything else. And there's dumpsters lining the entire alley. And it's just not the way that it's taught. So if somebody's not teaching an extreme, then nobody's ever gonna, you don't realize you need that until you get in a pickle and you don't have anything to fall back on. What is your plan? If you can't carry a 24-foot extension ladder by yourself, if you don't know how to set up chocks underneath a ladder to get it level, if you've never tried any of those things and you've just met the requirements of firefighter one and two, then what are you gonna do? You're just gonna stand there and let them die?
You are now, I mean, I don't want to say you've gotten a promotion because I don't really know, but you now are the logistics, the captain of the logistics division. My question to you is, is that a difficult transition from being one of the guys riding the trucks, going down the road, doing what you want to do to that role? Like, has that been an adjustment for you? And what's your take on sometimes taking a position you don't want to do, but might benefit not only you, but your organization?
Yeah, the worst part of this job, it's a staff job. I'm still just a captain. I just happen to be fulfilling a non-operations role. It's a support position. The worst part of this job is I'm pretty much by myself all day, every day. And the best part about this job is that I'm by myself all day, every day. And it definitely has its positives and negatives, but I still see myself as my role is to take care of our 32 stations, take care of the facilities, get the guys' uniforms. It's not exactly quartermaster, it's more focused on facilities. And I have another captain that he's in charge of fleet and equipment, and I still see it as a way that I can put forth as much effort as I possibly can in this role and still take care of the plugman. I can make sure that the guy's not running out of t-shirts on duty. I can make sure that their roof isn't leaking, although right now we have a bunch of roof leaks. I can put my efforts on taking care of the guys in a different way than what I did before. When I was on a truck with them, you can only influence your bubble as big as your bubble can be. And this is a way to influence a slightly bigger bubble. And, this leads into me having discussions with our admin chiefs a lot more often. Maybe we can get better equipment for the guys. Maybe we can get better conditions for the guys. So I still feel like I'm taking care of the plug. I want to be able to do that. It's just a different route of doing it. And I don't feel like it's, my wife is very quick when somebody says, "Oh, you work for Birmingham. What station do you work at?" And she says, "Oh, he's just the toilet paper captain." And I think that's hilarious, and that's great. But What's funny is if somebody says, "Don't you just do logistics?" She jumps all over them the exact same way and says, "Are you familiar with Quint 20?" Which is, it's great that my wife has the same position that I do
Gotcha.
about the station. So I'm still getting to take care of the guys. That's great. It does, I get to influence it in a different direction. And one that I honestly, if I hadn't taken classes at the National Fire Academy, if I hadn't done incident management stuff, I wouldn't have known the importance. But you can't put a fire out if you don't have a fire hose. You can't put a fire out if your fire engine doesn't pump. And in those support roles, they are not glamorous. You are not going to get firefighter of the year making sure that the station has toilet paper, but it would be a sad station if they didn't have toilet paper.
A personal question to you. Do you foresee yourself going back on the truck, or do you foresee, since you're in this position now, maybe going another route and becoming like a chief officer?
Yeah, then I guess one of the onboarding of any of the support staff, one of the negatives is how long there's not a very good route for continuity. So it takes a while to understand the financial aspects, where the money is, where it comes from, where it can go, how you get it, building all the relationships for the vendors. That takes a long time. So when you commit to taking one of these jobs, you're pretty much saying, "I'm doing this until I get promoted." They won't, not that they won't let you. If you give it a couple of years and then you say, "This is not for me anymore," they'll let you go back in the field. If you do a decent job, then you stay until you get promoted. But once you get promoted, the only route is back in as a chief officer, back into operations. So you don't get to ride around on the fire truck anymore, but you get to hang out with the guys again.
And but the main thing I still want people to understand, and you I think you hit the nail on the head, is even though you're not in a support role when it comes to suppression, you still need individuals doing exactly what you're doing, taking care of the men, such as logistics. Like every department needs a good logistics person. Some, hey, Cap or Chief, my uniform's kind of messed up. I got it. Something's wrong with my turnout gear. Bring it here. I'll send you another one. Something's wrong with the truck. So my point is, whether you're in suppression or not, you are still making a difference, which you mentioned it, but I want you to hear it, that we appreciate, and I'm sure most firefighters appreciate, individuals that aren't directly in suppression, but still assist the men and women over the organization to move forward.
Yeah, especially if they're there because they want to. If you're there because you want to hide, you don't want to make calls, then that's a whole different discussion to have. But I know I keep talking about Maslow's hierarchy, but it's true. The support roles meet those first two steps of Maslow's hierarchy, where you give people food, shelter, and safety. And those roles, if they're done correctly, are meeting those so that then they can go to a station where they learn how to be a firefighter and they're part of a crew and they get good at their job. And if they're not given, if you don't have fire boots, you're not going to be a very good firefighter. If you don't have a working fire truck, you're not going to be a very good firefighter. So they're definitely needed, and they are not glamorous, not at all.
Okay. You mentioned that you're part of the peer support team of Birmingham. I took a class not too long ago. I am a peer support member for the North Carolina region, and I definitely see value in it, because I'm sure, like me, when you were coming up into the fire service, it was leave your feelings at the door. Don't show weakness. Don't show emotion. Hey, stop crying. We don't do that. But now, with how we have seen the suicide rates of firefighters going up, what is, or what does truly being there for one another mean to you?
I don't know, maybe this is a selfish position to take, but after I took that class, what they try to do is in Alabama, they will add your name to a list of peer support people. And if you want to call somebody, you can call them. What I got out of that class more than how to be there for somebody was how to identify when a fireman has no place trying to be a mental health professional and to say, hey, this is outside of my realm of what I can help, but I know where the resources are. I know
Right.
how to get you the real help that you need. I have no business trying to tell you, yeah, exactly what you and I learned, which was just suck it up, whatever. And one of the benefits of everything that has sort of come out of the woodwork with mental health for firefighters is I see in urban firefighters sort of like death by a thousand cuts. It's not one, you know, if you ask somebody about one individual call, whatever, you know, they've done it a million times. It's not that big of a deal. But every one of those calls is another cut, another cut, another cut. And you realize 15 or 20 years into it that you're way more maybe messed up, or maybe you have a skewed view on reality. And with those peer support classes, we now can say, hey, here are resources, not just the peers. The peers are important. The peers are, it's been great to get to talk to people and learn that everybody has something going on. It's, you know, everybody has some burden that they're carrying. It's not just about the job, it's about life accompanying the job. And if we can just lead people to the resources that they need, that's the biggest thing that I see out of all of the peer support programs, is just getting them to a professional when they need a professional, or just to understand that I'm not a crazy person just because I don't cry when I see a dead body, or you know, whatever the situation is for the majority of first responders.
For sure. Okay. I always like to ask the guests this last question, and it is, where would you like to see yourself before you decide, like, it's my time, I'm ready to go, I'm hanging it all up?
Where would I, as far as assignment or in
As
general, whatever.
far as you can use, as far as where would you like to see yourself in rank in the fire service, or just where would you like to see yourself in life before you decide I'm ready to go? Because most of us give this profession our all, meaning our mind, our body. Sometimes it costs you your family if you're not careful enough. So at the end of the day, when you tell yourself, like, I'm going to put my papers in today, this day will be my last day, where would you like to see yourself?
That's an interesting thought for me. I do take still an immense level of pride in being our union president, and I could just as easily see me moving in that direction, taking that train toward a bigger level with the state or international, doing something labor related. On the other hand, nothing would make me prouder than being a Metro fire chief and being able to make change. You know, the buck stops with me. If this doesn't work, it's my fault. But then I have to look back inside and say, which one of those am I preparing myself to do today? And that's a tough look in the mirror to see, you know, if I'm Am I just saying that, or am I actually moving in that direction? And we've touched on education and experience and all that. And I see guys that maybe they gave up experience a little early in order to focus on a doctorate level education. And some that have said, oh, this person will be a good fire chief because they've been on the busiest fire truck. Well, when we look across the country, which one of those is becoming the fire chief? Not the one who spent 20 years on a fire truck. It's the educated person. So when I look in the mirror, am I preparing myself to be a Metro fire chief? Obviously not. I have not yet gone in any direction to get a master's degree or anything else. So wanting to do it and committing to do it are two certainly different things. And I think the likelihood is probably leaning in the direction of labor.
All right. Just because I'm curious and only answer it if you feel comfortable. That's one of the topics you hear where it's, is it experience or is it the paper? Is it the piece of paper that says I have an education this? My thoughts on it are, for company officers, do you need to have that piece of paper? It depends. Like, at least hopefully you have the minimum standard.
of that paperwork. When it comes to having a master's or whatever, I mean, me being frank, I think if you're a fire chief, you should have at least a 4 year and something just because you have to deal with city council, town council, public speaking, emails, grant, I don't want to say grant writing, but whatever fire chiefs have to do when it comes to writing down their thoughts and they have to articulate words a certain way. Is it the end all be all? No. Like, I think you can have a great fire chief that doesn't hold that piece of paper. But if they don't want to hold the masters, maybe they should just go with the minimum. It's just one of those things. You hear that argument all the time. Does a piece of paper make you a great fire chief? No, I know some individuals who are fire chiefs now that are splendid because they never forgot what it's like being on the line, on the floor. So I just wanted your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think, recognition prime decision making started in the fire service, right? And that's experience based. That is, you are looking at a situation and you are saying, I have this Rolodex of 10 options that I could do. And based on my experience, I know that this one would work in this situation. I don't care about the other options. I'm going to use option B until it fails, and then I'll move on to something else. Recognition prime decision making. It's a standard. It's taught in leadership everywhere. The other piece of that is that when you don't have the experience, you fall back on training and education. So what outcomes do you want? And if you want to be a fire chief or you want to be an administration, that's a weird position because the best firefighter in the world today, the best nozzleman, the best plugman, the best operator is not being taught how to be a fire chief. You don't learn through experience how to be a fire chief. So you have to rely, your recognition prime decision making looks at education. You fall back to education because you don't have the experience to get you through that decision. And you might just, you might be winging it. And when 1,000 people rely on you, winging it is not going to work.
Right.
It's not putting out a fire. It's not the same thing. It's a figurative fire when there's no money left and you still got to staff a fire station and keep the doors open. So the education is an important piece of it. I really enjoyed some of the public administration classes that I took, and I think it gives me a better view now about why we do things and what when somebody has an emotional reaction to a situation, you can say, hey, I don't like it either, but maybe it makes you feel better if you understand why this is happening, or what why admin didn't do a good job of explaining why we're doing this, but you should know here's why we're doing this. So the education is important, and I agree with you that there are lots. Experience can go a long way. I'm just not sure experience alone can get you into one of those administrative roles where you're representing the department well because you're a good public speaker. You write well, you present things well, you understand a budget. That's a lot to know. That's a weird role to have because who has the background of being an exceptional firefighter and understanding $100 million budgets? That's a weird spot.
Right. No. Okay. Love it. I love the conversation. Steven, I have to say thank you for accepting the phone call, the invite to come on and talk shop. I have to thank Clay and McGee for making this possible. Clay's been instrumental in allowing me to talk to so many great firefighters in the Birmingham and surrounding regions. So Clay, if you're listening, which I'm sure you will be listening to this episode, I appreciate you very, very
He's
much.
out on a hike listening to this right now, getting ready for the monster march in Oak Mountain.
Okay. All right. Steven, I appreciate you coming on, man, talking shop. I wish you the very best in wherever fate decides that you need to go to continue affecting positive change within the fire service, sir. I want to say thank you for coming, taking time out of your day to do this.
Thanks for the invite, Danny. This has been fun.
Appreciate you.